Welcome to Food Talk Radio. We are coming to you from the Vermont Law School campus in South Royalton, Vermont. This show is a collaboration between the students of the Food and Agricultural Law Society and the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems. Today's show is the first of the academic year. Moving forward, we will broadcast a new show on the first Tuesday of every month at 11 a.m. here on Royalton Public Radio. We are glad to continue our partnership with the radio station. Be sure to check out royaltonradio.org for more community news. Our episodes are available on iTunes under Food Radio Collective. In today's show, Katie Davis interviews Theo Fetter of Seven Bees Farm in North Tunbridge, Vermont. Lori Restino tells our Angel Rayford about the future of the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems here at Vermont Law School. And newly minted 1L students discuss whether the right to food choice is a fundamental right. This discussion is inspired by David Berg's Law Review article published in the University of Arkansas's Journal of Food and Law Policy. But first, Natalie and Emily report on this month's news headlines.
Hello and welcome to the news segment of the show. This is Emily Lane.
And this is Natalie, and welcome to Food and Agriculture News. Here are this month's global, national, and local headlines.
Here are this month's global news headlines. The recent climate change summit has prompted many to speak about the connection between agriculture and climate change. At the United Nations Climate Summit, FAO Director General José Graciano da Silva said in a speech that overcoming climate change is central to achieving a sustainable future for the planet's growing population, and food security must lie at the heart of that effort. We cannot call development sustainable while hunger still robs over 800 million people of the opportunity to lead a decent life. The next day, 75 countries and world leaders have issued their support for the Global Alliance for Climate Smart Agriculture, including President Obama and United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The Global Alliance for Climate Smart Agriculture calls for a voluntary coalition of stakeholders to help reform current agricultural practices to become more sustainable and able to withstand the impact climate change is expected to have on agricultural production. Their goal is to ensure food security for the 9 million people expected to be on the planet by the year 2050 by using new technologies developed specifically to address climate change. Europe and the U.S. are meeting in Washington for a seventh round of talks aimed at creating the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. The talking point or hot-button issue mobilizing Europeans to pay close attention to what this deal will bring is said to be that they do not want chlorine chicken, referring to the antimicrobial baths that can include chlorine to keep salmonella and other bacteria in check that most U.S. poultry is chilled in. Chlorine is not the primary concern for European public health. Rather, this idea is a symbol of larger issues such as the possibility of hormone-treated beef and genetically engineered crops entering the European market. In lighter news, using a DNA scanner, researchers in London found three mushrooms with no scientific names. They were in a typical package of mushrooms for sale in the supermarket. For the full story, listen to September 23rd's Morning Edition on NPR. British veggie breeding company Tozer Seeds has crossbred two beloved greens, kale and Brussels sprouts, to create a new hybrid that they're calling Kalelets.
And in national news, the first of the federal money from last year's Farm Bill has been deployed. The $52 million will be used to support local and regional food systems, such as farmers markets, food hubs, and research on organic farming. Last February's Farm Bill tripled the amount of money aimed at the organic sector, totaling $125 million over the next 5 years, with an additional $50 million for conservation purposes. The New York Times drew attention to a new variety of genetically engineered soybean and corn, which are resistant to glyphosate, also known as Roundup. Critics say the cultivation of these crops will lead to a sharp increase in the spraying of 2,4-D, which they claim is more damaging to the environment and possibly human health than Roundup. Some corn and soybean growers have been pushing for approval, saying the crops are a much-needed tool to fight Roundup-resistant weeds. The record of approval granted by APHIS is available on regulation.gov and claims that the approval is compliant with NEPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966, and the Endangered Species Act. 35 House Democrats are urging the Obama administration to prohibit children from working on tobacco farms, citing concerns about ill health effects. The Human Rights Watch issued two reports where they interviewed children who worked on tobacco farms. Nearly three-quarters of the children interviewed reported nausea, vomiting, and headaches. These symptoms are consistent with nicotine poisoning. In 2012, the Labor Department withdrew a proposed rule that would have banned children under 16 from several kinds of agricultural work, including work on tobacco farms. New York Times has reported that Bronx, New York resident Karen Washington is one of five winners of the James Beard Foundation Leadership Award for her work with urban and community gardening. According to the foundation, nominees are chosen for their outstanding initiatives, excellence of work, innovation and approach, and scale of impact within a community. Ms. Washington is well known in urban community gardening circles and has even been featured on PBS's Food Forward television series. The FDA is proposing to update the nutrition facts label, which is found on packaged foods. These updates will be made in an effort to modernize the label's content, as well as to draw consumers' attention to the link between chronic disease, such as obesity, and diet. Included in these changes would be an updated serving size requirement, which would be altered to represent the amount of food consumers actually eat, versus the serving size found on the current label, which represents what they should be eating. In local news, Burlington establishments, The Higher Ground and Skinny Pancake, hosted Eat by Northeast this September in what they called a three-day celebration of Vermont food. The event showcased seasonal foods from local farmers, a brouhaha with local beer makers, and over 30 free seminars. The event was successful in raising thousands of dollars for multiple Vermont nonprofit organizations, including Slow Food Vermont, and was attended by over 8,000 visitors. There'll be a hands-on backyard composting workshop at Burnham Memorial Library in Colchester on Monday, October 6th, between 5 to 6 p.m. The demonstration will go over how to transform food leftovers and yard debris into viable soil. The Floating Bridge Food and Farms Co-op is hosting a harvest market and pie-eating contest on October 12th, between 12 p.m. and 3 p.m. Their website boasts a day of learning, eating, and shopping. Local goods will be available, including cider, honey, and, of course, Vermont's favorite, maple syrup. For those interested in entering the pie contest or interested in attending the autumn festivities, more information can be found at floatingbridgefoodandfarms.com. And finally, we'd like to thank one of Vermont Law School's favorite reference librarians, Christine Ryan, for sharing her pumpkins with the VLS staff and student body. Christine has quite the green thumb and has produced an abundance of heirloom organic winter luxury pumpkins. Not only are they beautiful, but we hear they're delicious too.
My name is Theo Fetter, and along with my father, brother, and my dad's cousin, we have an emerging family farm called Seven Bees Farm here in North Tunbridge, Vermont, up on Whitney Hill. Two properties that are across the street from each other, one at 60 acres and the other at 50 acres. And the farm is in the planning stages right now. We're moving some earth around, but basically researching and planning. And right now our plans are to have a nut, fruit, and bean farm, dried beans. Fruit from berries to tree fruit and a variety of nuts, mainly walnut, hazelnut, and pine nut.
Seven Bees Farm hosted a permaculture work party with homemade pizza and local beer on Friday, September 26th. This is when our correspondent, Katie Davis, spoke to Theo Fetter and learned all about the up-and-coming Seven Bees Farm.
It's all being planned on a permaculture or riparian, which is restoration agriculture, set of principles. And we expect to be putting a lot of effort into this over the next few years, and maybe 5 or 10 years from now or some distant future, we'll actually have something to show for it.
Can you also explain the project we did today?
Yeah, today was a really fun project to finally begin building hugelkultur mounds. Hugelkultur is a permaculture technique. Hugel means mound in German, and it's essentially building an ecosystem, miniature ecosystem, a garden bed out of woody biomass covered by nutrient-rich topsoil and compost. The hugelkultur we're looking to build is about 8 feet wide at the base and mounds up pretty steep walls to its apex, which is about 4 to 6 feet high. The benefits of doing hugelkultur are low watering demands, if any, and also low fertilizer nutrient demands, if any. Many people who have built hugelkultur report that 20 years can go by without watering or fertilizing. And as the mound settles over time, of course, it loses some of its height and prominence in the landscape. But by that point, the plants you've established on it, maybe bushes or low or shorter trees, are well established and then are able to dig deeper into the underlying soils to pull up nutrients from down below. We built about a 12-foot long hugelkultur mound today, about 8 foot wide base and 6 feet high. And we just focus on the first stages, which are big logs and big branches, and then we began to put wood chips over it. After a solid several inches of wood chips covering the mound, you'd then continue to go with smaller and smaller material, which hold nutrients, of course, in a more ready-to-serve package for the plants in the following growing season. So next, after finishing the wood chips, we would go with compost, a mixture of compost and topsoil, and we purchased 8 yards of a perennial blend from Vermont Compost in Montpelier, which we had delivered today, and that stuff looks like black gold.
Yeah,
it does. Can't wait to get it on there and start planting into it.
When are you planning on using it?
Yeah, we plan on planting our hugelkultur beds that we build this fall next spring. So it'll have about 6 months of time for it to build its little community of microorganisms. I mean, we're very new to this, and you know, we read as much as we can, but we don't come from a science or an agriculture background. So I feel like, you know, 90% of the words I'm saying are poor vocabulary or a poor understanding of how things work. So taking with a grain of salt, I believe, or at least we plan to plant these beds in the spring and see what comes of it. We're also looking to establish 2 nurseries, one on this property and one across the street on my cousin's property this fall, so that we may be able to plant several hundred WIPs or seedlings next year and have those in our nursery for up to 5 years, and then transplant those to into the nut and fruit orchards.
Up next on Food Talk Radio, Angel Rayford reports on the future for the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems. On Wednesday, September 24th, U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy announced at Vermont Law School that the United States Department of Agriculture would be donating $759,000 in funding to support a 3-year partnership between the Center and the National Agricultural Library.
This is Angel Rayford, student at Vermont Law School. I'm here with
Lori Ristino. I'm the director of the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems and an associate professor of law here at Vermont Law School.
Can you tell us a little bit about the recent $759,000 funding that you received from Senator Patrick Leahy?
I can. Yeah. We're, first of all, let me just say we're really, really thrilled to be getting that funding. My center is actually all grant funded or philanthropic funded, so we have to raise money and we rely on people to give us grants. So having this $759,000 is really important and so wonderful, close to the beginning of our of the existence of the center, which is only a little bit over a year and a half old. So, and we owe a great debt of gratitude to Senator Patrick Leahy, who has been wonderfully supportive of the center, and it's through his efforts, really that we were able to establish that partnership, which is it's a brand new program, actually, that the National Agriculture Library is kicking off. And it's really about putting agriculture law resources up on in electronic form at the National Agriculture Library, which is really important to help farmers and other people who deal with agriculture and food to get legal resources and have access to those kind of tools.
Yeah, that sounds great. In that vein, can you tell us a little bit about specifically the CAFS program here at Vermont Law School?
Sure. So as I just noted, the center is really the newest center here at the law school, and we're only a little bit over a year and a half old. But what's amazing is because Vermont Law is such a special place, we've been able to build out one of the most comprehensive food and agriculture law and policy centers in the nation, which is really wonderful. So we're able to provide students who come here who have a passion for food and agriculture with a really comprehensive education on the leading edge of what's going on, and especially in sustainable food and agriculture.
$759,000 is a large sum, and it I'm sure it's going to impact the students' education in so many great ways. But can you get into the details of, you know, how the students will be affected, or some of the opportunities that will arise from receiving the funding?
Sure. So we'll actually incorporate students into executing the projects, and that's one of the ways we teach. We want to show the students everything from how we raise money to how we develop the project to how we accomplish the goals of the project, to how we take those tools that we develop from the project and disseminate them. So whether that be digital media, whether that be in-person trainings, and also how we partner with various organizations to really take advantage of or access their knowledge, because we know certain things, we don't know everything. So accessing their knowledge and also being able to distribute the information that we provide. So we really want to provide students with an entrepreneurial legal experience here so that they can go out if they want to when they get their law degree, and they can do the kind of work that they want to do. So if the job that they want out there doesn't exist, they are empowered and they have the tools to create that job. Or if they want to join up with a startup, they have the kind of tools that are really value added for that. So we really bring in a bunch of different skills and combine it with the law.
Okay, good. So you hear that, everyone. Vermont Law School and the CAFS program here, innovative in technology, innovative in food, and doing great things here on the campus with grants and partnering with local farmers and other organizations to bring Vermont Law students a comprehensive and innovative program.
Hello, I'm Stacy Shelton.
Hi there, I'm Max Krieger.
Hello, I'm Heather Devine.
And this is Angel Rayford, and this is Food Choice as a Fundamental Liberty Right discussion.
The first question that I have is, do you agree with David J. Berg when he says that buying meat from your local farmer is a fundamental liberty protected by the First Amendment?
Well, it's a hard question. And I think, you know, what he was talking about, not just buying meat, but buying meat without government interference, was the protection that he was most concerned about, the idea that being able to do something so basic as buying meat from a local farmer without having government get involved should be considered a fundamental right protected like other rights under the First Amendment. If you think about the purpose of the First Amendment, there can be a strong argument in for what he's saying, particularly the second, what I think of as the second purpose of the protection of the First Amendment, which is a protection of dissent, a protection of a minority. I think that the First Amendment protects dissent for not just the individual involved in the dissent, but also for the public good. And I think that's kind of the idea that we've talked about in separate area of jurisprudence and constitutional law that Justice Brandeis talked about, and protecting different ways of doing things within the states and having laboratories within the states doing different things, and how that's an important protection in our system and a brilliant protection in our system, because it enables us to keep alive alternative ways of thinking, alternative ways of doing things, so that if the majority way of doing and thinking turns out not to work because it just doesn't work or because the situation has changed, you can see this kind of, I think, with industrial agriculture. We've got this big system of industrial agriculture, and there are threats to that system because of its dependence on oil or its dependence on buying new seed, or you can have threats to the system with antibiotic resistant, new strains of antibiotic resistant pests. There are a lot of vulnerabilities in the industrial system, and if we didn't have any alternative to that, if we'd never had anybody else farming in a different way that didn't require the oil or didn't require the GMO seeds or didn't require these kind of inputs that we have in the industrial system, we would have no fallback if a crisis hits that industrial system. So I think that one of the really essential ideas in the First Amendment, I think it's important that it protects an individual's right to dissent, but I also think that it's an important protection for the public good to have alternatives to how you do basic things, alternatives to how you deal with commerce and how you deal with education, how you deal with food.
So Heather, saying is that you would be okay with Vermonters saying that they want their local farms to be unregulated by the federal government?
Yes, I would be okay with that, yes.
Awesome, thanks. What do you think, Max?
I think that's a fascinating proposal. I think that the scope of federal regulation as discussed in the article and the history of it is clearly targeted towards large industry, towards factory farming and that variety of thing, and clearly there can be a burden on the local farmer. But going so far as to call what he describes as basically the right to purchase meat directly from a farmer without regulation a fundamental right under the First Amendment, I think is going a little too far. I think that some regulation is definitely necessary. However, maybe the overarching scope of factory farm regulation won't apply to small farmers, and clearly it will be burdensome, and they might not be able to, you know, justify the expense, and it may create a barrier. But if you look at other First Amendment issues such as freedom of speech, freedom of press, there are still regulations within those. They're not unregulated completely. You can have freedom of speech, but you can't have, you know, hate speech. You can have freedom of press, but you can't have libel. You can't have, you know, defamation. And so I think just having an overarching blanket of this right should not be regulated, I think, is almost a dangerous statement to make.
Right. So you have a right to food, you have a right to eat, but you don't necessarily have a right to farm without having inspection, because that would be potentially dangerous to consumers.
Yeah, I think the public interest
outweighs the...
Or at least should be balanced with the personal right.
And yeah, the problem is I think it's the magnitude. So if it's just a few folks who are getting the food, why should the government step in on that and say you have to pasteurize your milk? So you can't just take pure milk from a cow and sell it. It has to be chemicalized in some way so it is preserved for a certain period of time. Why should that, why do we need that regulation? Maybe I see that for when it's a mass produced industrial style food source, which we certainly have today. But for these local farms, why? Why should they have to follow a regulation that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense when it's done in a small market? To specific consumers who know what they're getting and why they're getting it. And they don't want, you know, the things that government regulation add to that perfectly good milk. And I love the idea here that eating is a political act. And maybe, you know, we could talk about this from the side of the producer, but we could also talk about it from the side of the consumer. If it is a political act, then what are the consumer rights to that food and to getting it the way they want it?
So if the consumer has an explicit awareness of what they're putting in their body, how their food was farmed, who's the government to tell them no, as long as it's not being produced to the masses? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. I think it's a matter of scale. And the larger the scale, the more regulation required. I believe that. I'm glad we have that system in place. But the smaller the scale, I think there needs to be less regulation, or could be, or should be less. You don't need to regulate a small organic farm in Vermont the same way you do, Nabisco.
Right. From my standpoint, what I see is if we don't regulate the small local farmers, then it leaves room for an ununiform way of regulating food. And I feel like that's something that the government is concerned about, and I think it's a fair concern to have. If we don't regulate our local farmers, in my opinion, then who's to say that larger producers wouldn't want to follow suit and say, hey, they're not doing it, so I'm not doing it. And when the masses don't do things, and when things are not uniform, I feel like that's when there's room for error. And I feel like all the rules should be similar. And that's where I stand on the issue.
But we have examples in employment law, for instance, where if you have a business under a certain size, you don't have to follow the same employment laws that a larger company does. So we've got examples where it works just fine, where there's a uniformity of law based on the size of the business that you're regulating. I think that could translate perfectly well here.
What do you guys think, if any, the benefits are to federal regulations of local farmers?
I also see possible benefits in protecting the spread of disease through how the animals are taken care of. Or we live in a time where people are concentrated, even in rural places where we are here. It doesn't take us very long to get to a place where there are a lot of people, and people travel really quickly. So I think the government has a strong interest in containing disease and moderating, being aware of and moderating the conditions that could give rise to the disease.
All right, well, you heard it, Vermonters. That is the word on food choice as a fundamental liberty from Student Voices here at Vermont Law School.
That does it for today's show. Thank you for joining us. Food Talk Radio is produced by Katie Davis, Heather Devine, Angel Rayford, Natalie Kaleo, Emily Lane, and Coral Skeen. Thank you to Stacy Shelton and Max Krieger for your contributions to this episode of Food Talk Radio. Our faculty advisor is Lori Restino. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at VT Food Radio and like our Facebook page. The music you heard at the beginning of the show was provided by the Second String Band. Playing us out today with his song titled Wolves is Nate Ruby. When we're